It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, comedian and TV star Tracy Morgan visits Milwaukee tonight. He joins the show in just a bit.
First, in a recent piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Senator Ron Johnson criticized the Obama administration's handling of the deaths at an American consulate in Libya in 2012 and how it's handled information about the event since then.
His Republican colleagues in the House set up a new committee to continue investigations of the Benghazi incident. Ron Johnson joins us now. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Rob. Hello, Veronica. How are you doing?
Really good. So in that piece we mentioned, you were making the case that the public should still care and should still be trying to hold the Obama administration accountable. Why should this be a top issue in the public's mind?
Well, first of all, we haven't been told the truth, and I think Americans deserve the truth. I think the survivors of those four dead Americans deserve the truth. And you know, one of the things that has driven me from almost a couple of weeks after the Benghazi incident is I had a father of a young Marine come up and very forcefully demand that I get the truth for him, because he wanted to know whether his young Marine was serving under the command of a commander-in-chief that would really just throw away the age-old tenet of the military, leave no man behind, which really that was the outrage during the attack, that even though nobody knew that this thing was going to be over in 12 hours, nothing was sent to help the people in Benghazi, and that is an outrage.
What information is still out there, do you think, that hasn't come up in investigations until now?
Well, we have no idea really what President Obama did during the attack. We don't really know what Secretary Clinton was doing. Nobody's been held accountable. You know, the outrage before the attack is really the fact that even though the security situation in Benghazi was well known to everybody, and there were repeated requests for increased security, those requests not only were denied, they actually ramped down security. And I really truly believe, it's conjecture, but I think it's based in pretty sound reasoning, that just a small contingent of armed guards that the military would have supplied, I don't think that attack would have even occurred. I think that attack would have been deterred and four Americans would still be alive. So that's really the dereliction of duty that nobody has been held accountable for. We don't know who made that decision. We don't know that went all the way up to Secretary of State. In the Accountability Review Board report, Secretary of State Clinton was never even interviewed, never deposed. So there's an awful lot of information that we simply don't know, that I think the American people deserve to know.
When this attack happened, there were protests at embassies across the Middle East and probably security concerns everywhere. Was it just a matter of not knowing where something might happen and the available forces were spread thin?
Well, remember, Libya was a totally unique situation here. Yeah, we had the Arab Spring, and then we had protests in Cairo and throughout the Arab world. But Libya had just deposed Muammar Gaddafi. We had this consulate set up in Benghazi, and we were really one of the last remaining countries there because of the deteriorating security situation. The British ambassador was attacked. We had a 6-foot wide hole blown in the consulate wall, and yet we stayed there without armed guards. And again, this is conjecture, but I think this is probably a reasonable assumption, is that the reason we didn't provide armed guards is there was this narrative prior to the election that President Obama's policy of leading from behind, that was working well, that, Osama bin Laden was dead and al-Qaeda was supposedly on the run. That wasn't true. Al-Qaeda was metastasizing. It was become dangerous. It was very dangerous in Benghazi. But from my standpoint, that's probably why we didn't increase security and why we actually ramped it down Benghazi. And again, I just view that as a dereliction of duty that had the direct result of the fact that four Americans died that I don't believe had to. And again, nobody has been held accountable. And by the way, even though the president immediately said that we would bring justice to the terrorists, there's been no justice brought.
What would you like to have seen from the Obama administration about providing information about how they talked about this event in the, year and a half since?
Well, I would have appreciated the fact that they would have immediately told the American people the truth. I think it's pretty obvious, and of course my questioning of Hillary Clinton was pretty basic, and I was pretty respectful. I just said, why didn't you get on the phone and call the survivors? You wouldn't have had to, assume, you wouldn't have had to rely on talking points. You wouldn't have had to mislead the American public if you would have just called the survivors, because they would have said there was no protest. This attack started at 9:40 Benghazi time when those terrorists breached the wall. And so we could have actually been truthful with the American people for a number of weeks. So that's what I would have liked to have seen. And then since that point in time, provide Congress the relevant documents. What the Ben Rhodes email proves to us is, first and foremost, the White House did not fully comply with a congressional subpoena. That's pretty serious contempt of Congress from my standpoint. And then it also tells us that this cover-up, and that's why I think you can only take a look at it and say it's been a cover-up by this administration, was really hatched in the White House by, you know, somebody certainly involved with Ben Rhodes. So we're learning some things we should have learned a long time ago, and you would think by now politicians would realize that it's the cover-up that really gets them in a whole lot of trouble.
We've heard from some Democrats saying that Republican attention on Benghazi has been politically motivated. It's a talking point in this year's elections to damage Hillary Clinton, possible presidential run. Is that a fair attack?
No, because we wouldn't even be talking about it if we would have been told the truth immediately, if the administration would have fully complied with the subpoenas, and if there weren't so many unanswered questions. Aren't you somewhat curious what was President Obama doing the night of the attack? What exactly was Hillary Clinton? Are you kind of curious the fact that those two spoke about 10 o'clock at night? We do know that. And then about 8 minutes later, it was when the State Department really released one of the press releases that first starts to imply or implicate that, you know, the information on the Internet, I think is how they termed it. You know, so, again, I've got all kinds of questions. And what I can tell you is when I'm back in Wisconsin, a lot of Wisconsinites have a lot of questions, too, and they're demanding answers. So, you know, I think Republicans are justifiably responding to constituents' desire to get to the truth.
I want to get to a couple other issues before we're done. We saw a recommendation today from the FCC relating to the Internet and net neutrality, fast lanes on the Internet. You've said that Congress should get involved in the issue. What do you want Congress to do?
Well, from my standpoint, what Congress's role needs to be is really provide certain rules to foster maximum competition, which is good for consumers, you know, to protect consumers, and also maximum incentive for business investment and business innovation. And I think what the FCC just announced here on a totally partisan basis, I think will both harm consumers and really restrict investment in broadband, in the Internet, and as a result will really restrict innovation. And that's not good for our economy.
And do you think Congress should override what they've done and come up with some new policy?
Well, what's happened is a rule has been proposed and I believe put out for comment. I'm hoping that the public responds very forcefully to that comment period and realize really what's at stake. We are going to restrict, from my standpoint, the real free flow of information. We're going to restrict investment. And when you have all of this online content coming on stream through broadband, the last thing we want is companies that are actually investing in the infrastructure to carry all that content to not be willing to invest in the future. So we really are putting at risk future advancement of the Internet through, I think, this very unwise ruling.
And you've had an ongoing lawsuit related to the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. A couple points I'd like to bring up with that. There's been some criticism from groups mainly aligned with the Democratic Party saying you're using campaign funds, campaign money involved in that lawsuit. What is your response to what's been out there?
Well, first thing we did is check with Senate Ethics to find out how I could fund this lawsuit. And Senate Ethics either said I could pay for it personally, which I was willing to do, or use funds from my campaign. And I announced that the day I announced the lawsuit that I'd be paying it with the campaign funds. We haven't received a bill, so we haven't had anything to report yet. But I think what this shows is liberal groups understand how important this lawsuit really is, how it could be a landmark decision showing that this president, as in the words of Jonathan Turley, a liberal law professor here in Washington, said that this president has crossed the line, that we are at a constitutional crisis by his unilateral governance. And so that's really, you know, yeah, this is about a narrow regulation granted by the Office of Personnel Management. And that's the narrow issue of this lawsuit. The broader and the more important issue is the fact that Americans never wanted to be ruled by a king. We actually do value this tripartite form of government, the checks and balances to limit government intrusion to our lives, expand our freedom. That's really what's at stake, and that's the heart of my lawsuit.
And where is your lawsuit now? What's the status on that?
Well, Everything has been, you know, it's been filed, it's been responded to. The administration filed a motion to dismiss just based on standing issues. We responded to that. They responded to us. And now it's pretty much in the hands of the judge to rule first on standing, to, you know, rule that I have shown sufficient harm, or potentially that Congress has a role in here to really affirm our solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution by defending our powers, which are being degraded by the unilateral actions of this president. And hopefully this judge will also realize it's well past time for the judiciary to get involved in reviewing of this very important separation of power issue.
Senator Johnson, thanks so much for joining us again today. Appreciate it.
Have a great day.
We've been talking to U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Our next guest has explored just about every aspect of comedy. As a former cast member of Saturday Night Live, he introduced the world to characters like Astronaut Jones and Brian Fellow. More recently, he played an amped-up version of himself on the hit TV show 30 Rock. These days, he's hitting the road with his stand-up tour, Turn It Funny. Here's a clip from his recent Comedy Central stand-up special, Bonafide.
Grew up right down the block in the 80s. Growing up in the 80s was crazy. I was a crack dealer. But I felt sorry for the crackheads. I would sell them crack and didn't feel sorry for them because I was a crack dealer with a heart of gold. I just couldn't take it no more. I got frustrated with doing that stuff. I had to stop because I got tired of, you know, them bringing me $3.20.
And we caught up with Tracy Morgan during a busy day on the go for him in the lead up to a show at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee tonight. Tracy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you're coming to Milwaukee with your stand-up tour, Turn It Funny, and you've said stand-up is about being free, freedom. So what is it like when, as a comedian, all of a sudden the sky's the limit?
Well, stand-up is not just about freedom. It's also about knowing who you are in perfection, you know, and that's what I'm about, you know, getting to a great artist so they keep adding clay. He strips away till he gets to the bare essentials. So when I'm doing stand-up comedy, I'm not just out to be funny. I'm also trying to tell my perspective and my story and how I see life. Now, I got to tell life how I see it, not how nobody else sees it. I don't know how anyone else sees it. I can only speak for me.
Right, and it sounds like this tour and your Comedy Central special, Bonafide, are about being real, about sharing what it's like to be Tracy Morgan, sharing your life. What do you want people who come to see you to get about who you are and where you've been so far?
I just want people to see me with their heart and not their eyes.
And what does that mean as a comedian, to see with your heart?
You know what kind of person I am. Not what color my skin is and, you know, how short I am or how tall I am and things like that, you know. Not being prejudiced and just getting to know me and my story and my struggles and my joys and things like that. My sense of humor. To know me is to know my sense of humor.
So that's core to who Tracy Morgan is. It's the funny.
Part of who I am. Yeah, absolutely. You know, my life.
Well, so these days in your Turn It Funny tour, it's just you and a mic. What does it feel like to stand up alone after working so long with a big cast of people?
I've always done stand-up. Stand-up is my foundation to my career. So it's never been foreign to me. I've never stopped doing it.
And you're getting a haircut right now. I'm just going to throw that in because I think we're getting some exciting haircut noise in the background.
Yeah, that's it. Be done. So I'm all yours now.
Awesome. And I want to ask about your comedy special, Bonafide, that just got released on DVD. You talk a lot about your family, and there's a clip where you talk about your grandma and the uncle that nobody likes who was in Vietnam. Do you ever get worried that you're going to be in hot water with your family after you talk about them on stage?
No, why would I be in hot water? I'm a grown man. My life is my life. Well, it's short.
So does it feel like you kind of own it, and it's your story, and it's yours to tell?
Yeah. I don't do comedy and fair. As long as I'm doing it in the spirit of Jackie Gleason and Lucille Ball and all the other comedy guys that came before me, I'm okay. I'm not mean-spirited. I'm funny-spirited. Not being mean to anyone.
Yeah, I read somewhere that you said that we're getting, you know, maybe too touchy about stuff and people need to lighten up a little. Do you think that's true?
We need to laugh about it because if we don't laugh about life, I figure like this, yo, listen, you got to have a sense of humor. If we don't laugh about it, we're going to cry about it.
Sometimes
I'm just tired of crying, so I like to laugh about things and see the human thing. Let's kill a guy that adds a little levity. I'm just trying to add a little levity to life.
Is that something you think everybody could learn? I mean, people who go through rough stuff, you can get sucked under, and you can get sucked under.
Tough times don't last. Tough people do. And I'm a tough person. I know tough times don't last. Life is what you make it. And sometimes you got to bounce back. When you hit rock bottom, you got to bounce back up. It's only one way out of the bad one. That's up. So I'm looking up.
Has that been your thing your whole life, the laughter?
Well, that's what my father showed me. My father was a man with a great sense of humor. Plus, that's how I got the girls coming up. Women love a man with a great sense of humor.
Let's talk about girls for a minute. You've got a new baby daughter, and I want to say congratulations, first of all.
Right on. Like I said, women inspire me. My daughter's a female. She's inspired me to even get even better as a human being.
And has that changed your comedy? You've got three boys already. Now you've got this baby girl. Has it changed the guy on stage?
It's made me more hungry. I mean, it's made me look at life in a different way now because she's a little girl. I never raised a little girl before. You got to be a little bit more conscious. You know, my daughter's my queen, my princess. You know, so, yeah, it's changed me in that aspect.
Does that come off any different on stage, Tracy Morgan, the dad of the daughter, who you're clearly in love with?
I've been a dad a long time, and I love all my children the same. You know, all my children are those are from me. So I do what I do for all my kids, not just my daughter, but all my kids. I love all my children the same, male and female. I'm not acting brand new because I have a daughter. It's back to being a parent of a young child again. Instilling my virtues and my values. But, you know, my daughter's just special because she's a girl. She's a little girl, so I have to keep a stronger eye on her. Boys, they can pretty much take care of themselves. The little girls have a little bit more needs.
I want to talk about your stand-up some more and what it's like to get ready to go on stage, because to me that's always seemed like such an incredible feat of confidence and courage to get up there in front of people and just have you and your stories and hope that people laugh. How do you get in the mood for that?
You know, I do what I do. You know, I prepare. You know, I make sure it works before I get on. You know, it's comedy. This was born into me. I'm born this way. You know, comedy is like a reflex. Like you tap my knee and my leg goes up. You know? Comedy is just a reflex, you know?
Yeah. How do you get your material together?
When I was younger, a lot of my material was based on my imagination. And as I, you know, went through the world and started experiencing the world and seeing the world and traveling, a lot of it was based on my observation, things that I see every day. I just inject my sense of humor to it. But it's things that my comedy is based in reality. You know, if I had to describe it, it was called contemporary wit. You know, contemporary wit. I cut the monster, but I don't go into deep. I don't want to kill the monster. I know we need the monster, but it's contemporary wit.
And I read that you were thinking of adding some material about Donald Sterling, the Clippers owner. What is your take on that?
Well, you know, the world is just doing what it's doing, you know? I just sit back and I let the world do what it does, and then I take it from there.
So it sounds like you're just, like, the world comes in through the Tracy Morgan filter, and what comes out is your comedy.
Yes, that's what happens. The world is doing what it does every day. Just keeping my antennas up, keeping my ears open, my eyes open. And I'm seeing it. It's right there. It's reality. Turn funny. All the ups and the downs, I'm turning it funny. That's the name of the tour.
And do you think people who come see you and they get the Tracy Morgan experience and your point of view, do you think it ever changes them?
Well, I hope to. If I'm going to be on stage for an hour, I just don't want to be funny. I hope I touch somebody's psyche. I still have things, real things to say, too. I hope I touch somebody's heart. I hope I can change somebody's mind about something. Hopefully, you never know. Maybe. You never know.
And laughter can do that, right?
Sure can. Laughter gets everybody's attention.
Well, I read that you're a huge Marvin Gaye fan. I'm curious, what speaks to you about his music?
What was going on? It came from the heart. Marvin Gaye didn't make music unless he felt like it. So it came from the heart. That's what I like to do, my material, from the heart.
If you could only listen to one Marvin Gaye track that sort of summed up the Tracy Morgan experience, what would it be?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on? Gee, mercy, mercy me, and what's going on?
Awesome. Well, I'm going to let you go. I know you've got a busy day. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
Hope you have a great time in Milwaukee.
Thank you, Dave.
That was comedian Tracy Morgan. He was part of the hit TV show 30 Rock and a Saturday Night Live cast member for 8 seasons. He's bringing his stand-up tour, Turn It Funny, to Milwaukee tonight at the Pabst Theater. Bee colony collapse has perplexed scientists for the past decade, and it's worried food producers and the population at large. Apples, tomatoes, almonds, just a few of the many crops that rely on bee pollination to grow.
A new report out today from the Bee Informed Partnership with the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows that beekeepers around the country lost almost a quarter of their colonies this past winter.
That's actually better than expected, but still significantly higher than what's considered manageable. This is the 8th year for the report. The lead entomologist on the study has specific recommendations for ways to help stem the die-off. Dr. Dennis Van Engelsdorp is an entomologist with the University of Maryland. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you've been doing this, as I said, for 8 years now. How do the numbers look coming out of this winter?
Well, we've gone sort of from a situation that was horrible to one that's bad. So we, on average, over the last year, we've lost 30% of our colonies every winter. And this year, we're just coming in under 25%. I should say, though, that one of the things we added to the survey last year was that we started looking at losses over the summer, and that's not usually when bees die. And we found that the total loss this previous year between 2012 and 2013 was 50%, and then this last year it was 30%. So still, beekeepers are really suffering from unexplained, really high levels of loss.
I want to dig into the implications of that in a bit, but one of the big headlines here is that, you know, there's been this mystery, what's causing this? You have at least some more explanations in the report released today. What's going on, do you think?
Well, that's right. So we think that there are three different components to this problem. One is the varroa mite, which are these parasitic mites that pass viruses from bees as they feed on the bees' blood. The second is pesticides, both that beekeepers apply to control the mite and that is applied in the field, and poor nutrition. And we have growing evidence that a lot of beekeepers, that varroa mite populations are growing much faster than they used to. And so beekeepers really need to start treating much more aggressively in order to control the mite. Having said that, if we controlled all the mites, we'd still have some explained losses, but those loss rates would go down.
Well, let's tackle these three problems one at a time. You said these varroa mites, there are treatments out there for them. What would a beekeeper do to keep them under control?
Well, there are different products that they can use that are synthetic, and a lot of those products have lost some of their effectiveness. There are also organic-based products that are based on essential oils or natural acids. And then there are different manipulations beekeepers can do to reduce the rate at which varroa mites grow. And what we're finding is that beekeepers that are most successful are treating at least 3 or 4 times a year. They're not just relying on one treatment. They're aggressively treating multiple times a year.
Well, that's one method of pest control, but you mentioned that pesticides themselves, different kinds of pesticides, are also part of the problem. What kind of pesticides, and are they ones that we can do without?
Well, there certainly are a lot of products, especially backyard or gardeners, use more agricultural chemicals per acre than any other farmer, and we certainly don't need to use those. But there's growing evidence that there's a lot, like fungicides and other pesticides that don't kill bees outright, but they weaken the bees' immune system and make them susceptible to disease. And we think that there needs to be a lot more attention paid to that.
And there's been talk about neonicotinoids, a tobacco relative that's a source of a kind of pesticide. Is that one of the culprits?
Well, certainly there's been a lot of attention paid to neonicotinoids. And the idea is that these are pesticides that are painted on the seeds, and as the plant grows, it sucks up these pesticides and expresses in the pollen and nectar. And certainly in lab experiments at very high doses, we can see some effects on bees, and even at very low doses, we can see some effects on bees. But we still haven't shown that it's killing colonies outright, and so that's a missing piece. Certainly there are other pesticides that are doing the same thing, so we need to look at pesticides in more general sense.
And the third culprit you mentioned is nutrition for bees. What's the problem there?
Right. So in the United States, the sort of summer ground right now for bees is in the North, South Dakota, and Minnesota area. And that's because there's a lot of fields there that have flowering plants. But with the price of corn and soybean, all those meadows, or a lot of those meadows, have been plowed under. And so there's not a lot of clean forage for bees to eat anymore. And so we really need to look at how we incorporate good, clean forage in our landscape in order to support honeybees and also other pollinators.
So if bees are only getting nutrition from the crops they're pollinating, that isn't enough for them.
That's right. And so they need variety, just like we do. We need variety in our diet to keep us healthy. They need a variety of flowering plants that flower at different times of year.
So painting the full picture here, the bees aren't getting enough nutrition. They're being weakened by pesticides. And I guess both of these would make them more vulnerable to disease spread by the varroa mites.
That's absolutely right.
So you've mentioned some of the solutions here. I want to delve a little deeper into the problem now. One of the things in your report talks about kind of the rate of acceptable losses for beekeepers. Are beekeepers losing so many bees that it's driving them out of the business or the hobby?
Well, actually, there's been a boom in the backyard beekeepers or the hobby beekeepers. There's a lot more people since this problem arose. A lot of people have become interested in bees, and that's great. So we've seen a real rise in the number of small beekeepers. But 95% of the beekeepers only manage 5% of the colonies. It's that 5% of the beekeepers that own 95% of the colonies that we really rely on to pollinate the fruits and vegetables in this country. And those beekeepers are getting hit really hard. A lot of them are in business because of love, not because of the economics anymore. Because trying to replace 30% to 50% of your colonies every year is really expensive. And we've seen some of these guys go out bankrupt, and we're worried that this trend continues. More and more will go out of the business. And they're very hard to replace because commercial beekeeping is a very complicated skill set. It's not like anyone can just jump in and become a commercial beekeeper.
So if we lose too many of these big beekeepers, is that going to be an agricultural crisis for us?
Well, that's right, because one in every three bites of food we eat is pollinated directly or indirectly by honeybees. And so if we want to produce almonds in this country and apples in this country, if we want to produce vegetable seed in this country, we need to have a movable pollination force in order to pollinate those plants to set the fruit or the seed.
So what would you like to see? Are there I don't know, government policies or changing business practices that need to happen to keep their hives going and keep those big beekeepers in business?
Well, we're really working hard at trying to figure out what the best beekeepers, the ones not losing many colonies, are doing and get the word out about good management practices. We think that everyone can do something to help solve this problem. One is to support local beekeepers by buying local honey. And the other is to think about not spraying herbicides in your lawn and let it become a pollinator meadow, and also plant pollinator gardens and think about how we can encourage flowering plants that grow year-round that are pesticide-free in order to support honeybees and other pollinators.
How about wild bees, not the honeybees that the big beekeepers have? Do they play any role in pollination, any significant role in pollination of crops?
Well, you're absolutely right. They're really important for the ecosystem, the native bees. There are over 3,000 species of native bees in this country. Most of them are very small, and we don't really have a good handle on what's happening to their populations. But we do know that if honeybees and these native bees are foraging on almonds or other crops, that the fruit set is even better. So having these part of the picture is really important, and that's why we're worried about the fact that some, like bumblebee species, for instance, we think have gone extinct over the last 20 years. And so we really have to start monitoring all those pollinators and doing things that are good for all pollinators.
At the outset, you said, looking at the numbers, we've gone from years of horrible to a year of bad. Am I being too optimistic to hope that might be a trend where maybe next year it'll be only a little bad and beyond that, or is it hard to project that?
I think it's hard to project that. I think that we've done it for 8 years, and what we see in those 8 years is looks like it's cyclical. So a really bad year is followed by a better year. It's still a bad year, but it's better than the year before. And so I think we want to see 2 or 3 years of this before we feel good about it. And it certainly has to get lower than 20% in the winter or 30% overall the year for the bee industry to be healthy again.
All right. Dennis, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with University of Maryland entomologist Dennis Van Engelsdorp. He leads an annual survey in partnership with the USDA on bee colony collapse. New report out today. And by the way, he mentioned backyard beekeepers. On Monday, we'll hear a Wisconsin Life episode talking to people buying bees for their backyards and then talk to an expert on how to start your own hive. It's not summer yet, but it's never too early to start planning our summer book binges and putting our must-read list on hold over at the library.
Steve Paulson is the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge here at Wisconsin Public Radio. He's also one of the station's most voracious readers. He joins us once a month to share some highlights from his adventures in reading. Steve, welcome back.
Oh, it's fun to be here.
Well, what have you got for us this time?
Well, I have several books to talk about, and I was going to start with a book, a collection of short stories by Lydia Davis, who is, I think, one of the most interesting fiction writers around. And she's really revered by a lot of other writers. In fact, last year, she won the Man Booker International Prize. And she's, I mean, the thing that people really notice about her is a lot of her stories are very short. Now, she has some stories that are sort of the conventional length of, you know, 20 to 30 pages. But she has other stories that are a paragraph long, a few sentences, sometimes a single sentence.
So she's pushing the boundaries there.
Exactly. And she's obviously very exacting about the language that she uses. And she sometimes is writing about her dreams. She has this whole section of stories about cows. She lives out in the countryside. Or sometimes it's just kind of observations about what she's thinking about, sort of portraits, glimpses of her inner life. And they tend to get a little philosophical.
And how is it for reading? Is it good stuff to read? Does it hold you when these things are so short?
Well, do you want a taste?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, so let me, I'll read you a couple of the shortest stories. Well, not the single sentence stories, but you can decide for yourself. So here's a very short one called The Dog Hair. The dog is gone. We miss him. When the doorbell rings, no one barks. When we come home late, there was no one waiting for us. We will find his white hairs here and there around the house and on our clothes. We pick them up. We should throw them away, but they are all we have left of him. We don't throw them away. We have a wild hope if only we collect enough of them, we will be able to put the dog back together again.
That's a downer. But yeah, a very short, a story in a microcosm.
It is. I mean, there's sort of a, you know, beginning, middle, and end, kind of, in a few sentences.
Yeah.
But, you know, what she's doing is she's kind of making you think. She's sort of almost throwing an idea out there just very concisely. And can I read you another one?
Yeah, please.
So there's, she, as I mentioned, she often does stories that are kind of recounting dreams of hers. And, you know, so a lot of the, I mean, we all have dreams. And, you know, they're usually just kind of throwaway things. And, you know, she turns them into literature in a way. So anyway, here's one called Awake in the Night. I can't go to sleep in this hotel room in this strange city. It is very late, 2 in the morning, then 3, then 4. I am lying in the dark. What is the problem? Oh, maybe I am missing him, the person I sleep next to. Then I hear a door shut somewhere nearby. Another guest has come in very late. Now I have the answer. I will go to his room and get in bed next to him, and then I will be able to sleep.
Ooh la la. Wait, so that is a dream or a real thing?
That's a dream. No, that's a dream.
Is she up front? Does she say this?
She says, yes, it says dream on the bottom. So there's a whole collection of these. So, you know, you can take them for what you want. So it's just like, it's almost like little kind of thoughts that are put out there. And as I say, she has longer stories as well. And so it's just, it's kind, to me, it's very liberating to read something like this because it's, oh, you know, I don't have to, I mean, I don't write short stories myself, but if I did, I could imagine that, you know, I don't necessarily have to sweat it out and, you know, construct a very elaborate story. I mean, stories can come in all shapes and sizes, and it's whatever grabs the reader. And so she really is sort of expanding, I think, the boundaries of what literature is.
And that sounds like a great one to read if you are really interested in sort of the boundaries of literature and what's happening at the cutting edge there. What if you just want a really good read and something that's going to make you turn the pages really fast?
Okay, well, that leads us directly into the next, actually, couple of books that I want to talk about. There's a writer named Jeff Vandermeer who has a trilogy coming out, and it's kind of this very unusual concept of what he's doing. He's actually publishing 3 books in a single year. So 2 books have already come out. I've read them both. The first one is called Annihilation, and the second one that's just out is called Authority. And a third will be out later this year, and that's all part of what he calls the Southern Reach Trilogy. And they've all been optioned for the movies by Paramount Pictures. They're kind of sci-fi stories, very hot. I mean, this will be on people's radar. And so it's sort of this mix of science fiction. There's kind of a little element of horror here, you might say. He calls them weird fiction. In fact, he and his wife Anne edited a whole anthology of writing called Weird Fiction.
Yeah, what does that mean?
It means kind of stories about the inexplicable. Not necessarily the supernatural, but it's stuff that you can't really explain. And so the idea for this series is Jeff Vandermeer himself had a dream where he was walking down into kind of a tunnel in the ground and sort of going down and down, and noticed there started to be writing on the walls, and the writing itself was alive. It was pulsating, and then sort of kept walking down further, and then realized that the writing was getting fresher and fresher. It was sort of like more alive, and realized that if he walked down more, he was going to encounter the creator of the dream. Mm. And he woke up. And so he thought, oh my goodness, you know, that's the basis of a story. And he's someone who, because he kind of writes in this vein of weird fiction, he actually intentionally sort of tries to cultivate sort of tapping into his subconscious to sort of get a glimpse of non-ordinary reality, you might say. So the basic premise of these stories is there is this weird area. It's kind of in Florida. It's sort of a slightly alternative world. And some strange stuff has happened, like in the swamps of Florida. People start dying there, strange creatures start emerging. So then the government shuts it off. They create a border there, and there's this secret governmental agency called the Southern Reach, and they're kind of in charge of making sure people don't go in there. But they also send a few expeditions in. So this one story is there are 4 people who go in, and they slowly either die or go mad. Mm. And they sort of find all kinds of strange stuff. And so the stories are all about, so what is all of this about? And I could give you a taste of this,
yeah,
if you
definitely
would like.
Please.
So this is from the first book called Annihilation. And so the main character, the narrator, who just goes by the name The Biologist. So she's kind of describing some of the stuff that she has seen. And it's set in kind of an area of Florida where actually there are dolphins that come into sort of the fresh water. So it's sort of a playoff of that. And so she goes, I knew that the dolphins here sometimes ventured in from the sea, had adapted to the fresh water. But when the mind expects a certain range of possibilities, any explanation that falls outside of that expectation can surprise. Then something more wrenching occurred. As they slid by, the nearest one rolled slightly to the side, and it stared at me with an eye that did not, in that brief flash, resemble a dolphin eye to me. It was painfully human, almost familiar. In an instant, that glimpse was gone, and they had submerged again, and I had no way to verify what I had seen. I stood there, watched these twinned lines disappear up the canal back toward the deserted village. I had the unsettling thought that the natural world around me had become a kind of camouflage.
That does sound intriguing.
So strange creatures, human-like. It turns out they have powers. There's sort of this metaphor of maybe this area is in mysterious area X is infecting the rest of the world that we know. And these stories are what's going on.
Oh, that sounds chilling. So those are going to be made into movies, you said?
Apparently. Well, they've been optioned
for the
movies. So I would not be surprised. I mean, they seem rather cinematic, I have to say.
It's nice to know that if you read the first 2 of those, that there will be a third in the year.
Which is coming out in the fall. Yeah.
Which is more than we can say for readers of George R. R. Martin's books, which are never
right, what, every 5 years or something like that?
If that, yes. Right? All right. Well, let's move on to the last pick you've got. This one is another big prize winner.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is nonfiction. It's called Tom's River by Dan Fagan, a science journalist. And this is the book that actually won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction just this last month. And I am quite sure that this will become a classic of environmental journalism in the years to come. And it's a story about cancer clusters in a town called Tom's River on the New Jersey shore. And basically the story is back in the 1950s, a chemical company set up a dye manufacturing plant, and it brought all kinds of good things to the town. I mean, it brought jobs, it brought they did a lot of charitable work in the community. But this manufacturing plant was dumping its toxic waste straight into the ground. In fact, it was piping some of it straight out into the ocean. And Later on in the 1980s and 90s, lots of cases of cancer started coming up. And some of the parents said, you know, I bet it has something to do with this manufacturing plant. But it was really hard to prove. No one really wanted to talk about it. You know, people liked having the manufacturing plant there. So this is really a story of how scientists and sort of prodded by parents and nurses started to investigate this. And it turns out it's actually incredibly hard to prove cause and effect of, okay, you think that you see this environmental waste there, these toxins, and to sort of prove that this leads to cancer. And so Dan Fagan in this book, he's basically walking us through the science of this. And I mean, it's a 500-page book, so it's very detailed.
It sounds like there's lots of terrain that he explores in there. And one of those is as you said, how hard it is to establish causality between
right.
whatever the pollutant mm-hmm. is, whatever the toxin is, and the cancer clusters. What other nooks and crannies does he get at? What questions does he raise?
Well, he's raising questions. So there's the whole science of this. So if, you know, you're looking for patterns of exposure, you're looking for places where there's high exposure, and then looking for other more cases of this, and it involves computer models and all of that. There are the ethics of this. There's the legal settlement. And so, I mean, one of the morals of this story, in a way, is these families ended up getting a legal settlement, getting money, but it's not what they, it's, you know, they got somewhere between $100,000 and $500,000 in some cases for their children that died. So, I mean, obviously not enough money, but it's sort of, it's what they could get in the legal system. And then the manufacturing plant closed there in New Jersey, moved to Alabama, later moved to China. And what he's saying is, you know, chances are the same story is happening in China where there is less regulation or other parts of the world. And then he has this very chilling conclusion. He says, right at the end of the book, the chief legacy of this whole case was to solidify government opposition to conducting more investigations like this. I mean, it took years to try to sort of pinpoint this correlation between environmental toxin exposure and then these cancer clusters. And so, I mean, no one really wants to do this. And so, I mean, part of his conclusion is, you know, these kinds of investigations will only happen, and they should happen, when there's enough pressure brought to bear. And it's probably going to be from parents, from concerned citizens, because, you know, the local politicians probably are not going to want to do that.
Excellent. Well, another one that's sounds like a serious and important read, a Pulitzer Prize winner. Steve,
yeah.
Thank you so much for coming by and sharing these with us.
Oh, it is always a pleasure.
That was our Lord of the Books, Steve Paulson. He's also the executive producer of Wisconsin Public Radio's To the Best of Our Knowledge.